Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Mike Hopkins, an associate head coach for Syracuse University's men's basketball program. He's in his 18th season as a coach with the Orange, and he played on the team from 1989 to 1993. He's also been involved as a coach in international and Olympic efforts. Mike, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, for you and for our listeners, let me just start first by saying what I'm not going to ask you about, and then we can go from there. I'm not going to ask you about what it's like to be waiting to be the head coach, and I'm not going to ask you about Bernie Fine. I think those topics have been covered by other media sources extensively. So I had some other things I wanted to get into with about basketball and about collegiate sports. And the first one is, you know, the place of high-profile college sports in our society, the effects that it has on high school kids and the players in college, other kinds of topics. These things get debated a lot. And so this might be an impossibly broad question, but how well do you think the system of big-time college sports works overall?
Well, I think it works, you know, I think it works really well. I think, you know, we're in debate all the time, you know, should athletes get paid, you know, going back and forth. I thought Coach Boeheim had some amazing comments recently when he talked about, you know, what colleges do for, you know, prospective professionals, you know. So they're saying, well, they're coming and they're making millions of dollars. Well, we're giving them the platform. We're giving them the stage. We're giving them a $55,000 a year education. We're giving them the exposure. So, you know, I think I'm with that. I'm not for paying athletes. I think student athletes come to get a great education. If they make it, that's great. If they don't, I mean, you have the rest of your life to, you know, get a good job and get exposure to boosters and alumni and opportunities that normal students wouldn't get.
And I wanted to ask you about that question of paying the players. In particular, one might say, well, you know, you give them the platform, but also they're waiting for this big payoff down the road. And while they're playing in college, you're exposing themselves at risk of injury, and you get all that going on. So wouldn't it be a little fairer and just sort of more honest for the schools to go ahead and say, look, you know, we're gonna treat this like the NBA, give you your NBA player cut kind of thing?
I don't think so. I don't think that's I think the kids that are coming, okay, for instance, we're recruiting a lot of kids that have big dreams and aspirations. And you'll be sitting there, we'll be at a recruiting dinner, and you'll look on television, and we'll have on the ticker under ESPN, so-and-so just signed for $27 million, four-year guaranteed contract. And the first, oh, he's not that good. He got $27 million. He's not that good. So even the understanding, the education of what, you know, these kids, if they get a four-year degree and they become an educator, they become a school teacher, and their first starting salary is $37,000, you know, I don't think they have the gauge in their brain to say, this is a heck of a job, this is a great opportunity to grow and get here, when you're sitting there going, this kid's horrible and he's getting $27 million guaranteed for 4 years. Do they think they're a failure? Where does that make their, you know, how does their mindset make up? And I think that's where the culture of basketball, it gets a little bit distorted, especially at the AAU/high school level.
And you said at the beginning that you thought overall the system works pretty well.
Yeah.
Is there one aspect about it, though, that you think doesn't work? Is there one worst aspect?
Well, I think, okay, they talk about paying athletes. I don't think that you should pay, you know, a kid $10,000 to go to college. But a lot of the kids that have need get Pell Grant. So a lot of these kids are getting 42, you know, if you're a full Pell Grant guy, you're getting about $4,000 a semester. So now you're getting $8,000 a year. That's over $1,000 a month that you're in school, as well as your scholarship. Now, the one thing that I would suggest is for the kid that maybe combined mom and dad, you know, if they make $60,000 a year and you're not eligible for Pell Grant, but they might have five or six children in their family. So maybe they expand for a student athlete, you know, what you're eligible for a Pell Grant from federal aid for some student athletes. So it's to be able to have some spending money. It's to be able to have a coat and to have boots. And they've had programs now. We had the Big East Fund where if you were eligible for Pell Grant, they would allow you to have a $500 to go buy some, you know, boots and a jacket and stuff like that. So it's not, you're not asking for a lot, you're asking for a little. But I think the way that they do the Pell Grant, would be another way to be a creative way to get student athletes a little bit more money.
And you were talking just a minute ago about the kids seeing these big contracts. And so let's set aside for a moment the kids who do go on to get the NBA contracts. It does seem like the athletic scholarship process does work out very well for some kids, but then, you know, not so much for others. And we can think of examples where there have been problems. What do you think in your experience are the most important factors that make for the difference between the kids who really sort of this all works out for, and they go and they get a teaching job and it's all great and they wouldn't have had that opportunity before, and those that really sort of crash on the rocks on the, along the way on those?
Well, I think, you know, the value of education. We were talking a little bit earlier when we were coming down the stairs, and I had mentioned to you, I went to – my father was a successful entrepreneur, had a family-owned business. I went to the best high school in the state of Southern California, with the modern day, with great education. Parents stressed that, how important it was. My first 3 years at Syracuse, you know, I wanted to be a professional basketball player. And I had I was getting hammered by my mom and dad all the time. And I had all the resources to be, you know, to do exceptional things academically. It just – it wasn't my focus. And it took me – you know, I was a redshirt, so it took me my fourth year, or, you know, would – you know, I was here for 5 years, so it took me that fourth year to really understand the value. My grades really shot up. I became more mature. And I think that's part of it. I also think it's part of having great coaches, great mentors. Coaching, the one thing I love about coaching is having that impact, you know, to be able to tell them, you know, even though you think you're going to make it, there are possibilities that you might not. What can you do now? And I was very lucky at Syracuse to have Coach Boeheim and Timmy O'Toole, who were great role models for me, you know, teaching me what athletics could do to help me be successful in life, as well as, you know, showing me that, you know what, Mike, you might not make it. That's when the emergency button was pushed, and I said, you know what, I just got to start studying more. But the value was, I think, the maturity that I went through and having great coaches.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Mike Hopkins, Associate Head Coach for the Syracuse University Men's Basketball Program. You were talking about your own experience there and where the light for you went on in education toward the end of your undergraduate time. I was curious to know whether, just from the standpoint of the different time demands, that it was hard for you to get a quality education and also do the basketball, because it just seems like it's a very long day.
Well, if you think about this, most student athletes, I'm going to talk about men's basketball across the board, don't have, or if it was based on my grades in high school as well as my SAT, I wouldn't have been accepted to Syracuse University. And that, I would have to say, that's 80% to 90% if you went nationwide in terms of the schools that these kids go to. And then on top of that, now you're taking a 20, 30 hour a week job, per se, and then you have the stresses of family, you know, you're maybe not up to par academically with your peers, your struggle, you're doing study table hours, the demands, travel. So, you know, the student athlete has a lot of demands on them, like you're saying. But I think most student athletes are very, very competitive. So whatever you focus on, I think you can be successful in. So my focus as a student athlete was basketball. I wanted to be a pro. It was my dream. So every day that I got up, I wasn't thinking about, geez, I have this history test today. I was thinking about, how do I get in the starting lineup? So, you know, from, you know, running at night or getting extra lift, you know, or, you know, I was a skinny kid, so I was constantly eating, you know, eating, making milkshakes at night and protein powder. I did everything possible to make that dream come true. And that's where I thought, when the light turned on academically and I realized how important it was, that maturity, that great coaching, now I was able to turn a focus and I became competitive academically. And I saw myself just rise successfully because that's what I wanted to do. And I think a lot of kids feel that way, especially student athletes.
Now, you stayed here for the whole time.
Yeah.
Not everybody does, and that's one of the reasons I, at least in my reading and my understanding, that this idea of paying players gets put forward, because this is going to be a way to keep the kids at the school for the whole time. You're not in favor of that, but are you in favor of any other kind of proposals to maybe changing the NBA draft eligibility requirements, you know, to raise those? I don't know.
I think the idea of if a player would like to go to the pros out of high school and he doesn't have his mind on going to college, why are we making them go to college? You know, we have 18-year-olds that are going into the military. They're fighting for our country. Allow them the opportunity, okay? I also think something for a student-athlete, because everybody matures at a different time, and everybody's different. You see a lot of athletes fall on hard times, and you say, well, geez, if you look back, you had the opportunity. You were in college. But going back to the time demands, their focus, being below, you know, the bar in terms of what their the rest of the student body is. If you're going to make this money for the university or, you know, college athletics for these conferences, give them an opportunity. If they sign a letter of intent, a document, let them have a lifetime to get their education. Mm. So when you see a player that made $100 million and then 15 years later lost $100 million, you know, let them, like if they went 2 years or three, let them go back and finish their degree. Make it a forever piece for student athletes.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Mike Hopkins, associate head coach for the Syracuse University men's basketball program. Some people in the sports media have called you a statistics junkie. I've read that phrase. How much of good coaching, in your view, is analytical in the head, and how much of it is in the gut?
Well, I think, you know, my boss in general, he's the best gut guy on the planet. You know, I watch him, and everything is through experience and having so much experience. You know, you can see it's his mind. You see the neurons. Everything's just clicking at the same time, just figuring this thing out. But in a strange sense, he has his own analytics. And I was reading an article yesterday, and Eric Spoelstra, the head coach of the Miami Heat, had said, "You call it analytics now. Back in the day, we called it statistics." Just different ways that you look at it. I like it to be able to sell your players on getting better. For instance, I had a friend, we were doing some statistical analysis, and he said to me, he said, "Mike, do you know Bimu Sakata, our center at Syracuse, is one of the top offensive rebounders in the country per 40 minutes of play," okay, and whatever his number is. "But on the flip side, he's one of the worst defensive in terms of minutes played." So I, ding, 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 I walk right up to Bi. I'm like, "Bi, come here." Okay, you know, now we've been talking about offensive rebounding. You play with such a great motor. You've been going really hard. But you know what? We really have to work on the defensive rebounding. Do you see the numbers? Mm. The numbers don't lie. they may not tell the whole truth, but they don't lie. So I like the combination of using analytics as well as gut. I think I'm 50-50. I like the balance of it. So I think it's also another way to sell your players on something that you're trying to get across. For instance, a great stat. My friend coaches at the University of Miami. 2 years ago, they were rated 118th in the country in field goal percentage defense at 41.5. The most definable or the most synonymous statistic for Final Four teams in the last 20 years is being in the top 10 in the country in defensive field goal percentage. So he said, if you get one more stop per half and retain possession, which means if the other team shoots, you get the rebound, they don't score that basket, and we retain possession, that they would have gone down from 41.5, and I might get these numbers mixed up, to 37.5, which would be seventh in the country. Mm. So you would go from 118th to seventh in the country if you just got one more stop. Now, it's like the one commercial that you see, just one more, just one more. So that's an easy thing to sell to your team at a timeout. Guys, it's something that one more stop. This is our stop. We need to get this stop. We need to retain this rebound. And you can see it's like compound interest when these kids look at it. Geez, one more stop, we do that, we'd be in the top 10. It shows you the fine line, but it also sells your team on what you're trying to accomplish.
And I've interviewed many politicians on this program, and I've heard many of them say that for them the low of losing is bigger than the high from winning. And I wanted to know if that was true for coaches too.
No, I think that's very true. I'm probably a little bit more optimistic. My boss said last night at a dinner, he said, if I can give anybody advice in this room tonight, is losing's not good. And he said, do you all know chutes and ladders? Do any of you kids play chutes and ladders? And a lot of kids raised their hand. He says, I hate to lose at chutes and ladders, and I'm probably known to cheat a little bit to make sure I don't, which wasn't the greatest message. But the idea of it was is that's how much he hates to lose. So, for me, I'm more of the process. And I don't know if it's my detriment, but I focus on how do I get better tomorrow, how do I get better today?
And what speaking of the losses, though, what would you consider to be your most difficult loss as a coach?
I think the most difficult thing for a coach, I think, is when you lose to a team that you know you can beat. I think that's a tough thing. Or, so much in basketball is timing, and so much of it is luck. So much of it is, we lose 4 out of 5 at the end of the year, and then all of a sudden we get on a run in the Big East tournament. We get to the Final Four. And, we beat some teams that were probably where we felt we overachieved. I thought Indiana was a great team. Our defense was great. And then we played Michigan, and we didn't play our best game. Mm. And I think the hardest thing for a coach when you get to that level is not playing your best game on that moment. You get that moment. I was watching The Voice last night. You get that moment for the knockout round. And you just – the hardest thing is going to be like, why didn't we play our best? What did we do? You go back and you self-evaluate. But I think that would be the hardest thing for me.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and I'm talking with Mike Hopkins, associate head coach for the Syracuse University men's basketball team. Well, a poll of head coaches ranked you the second – most feared recruiter in college basketball. That's high praise. So do you have one particularly memorable recruiting experience that you can relate to me?
Well, Jerry McNamara, a little kid from Scranton, Pennsylvania, and, everybody talked about Notre Dame, Irish town, Irish Catholic, and he had Notre Dame pillows, Notre Dame bedspread, going down. His uncle was the mayor of Scranton, and I my goal at that time was I was gonna become part of the family, and I always thought that I wanted him. If he was gonna say no, it would have hurt him more to say no to me than anybody else, and so my first son, my oldest son Griff. My wife was pregnant, and she would go down to games with me. And Syracuse, we sell the family. And I tried to get in with the family. We recruited him like he was family. We recruited his entire family, from the mayor to his mom to his uncle to the local bartender to the so-and-so. I would always make a comment. I'm like, if Coach K or these guys come in here, man, we need the Syracuse Mafia. You need to tell me. You need to call me, we sold Tipperary Hill. We sold everything. But I think the greatest thing about people from Scranton, especially the McNamaras, it's a very similar community as Syracuse. Very hardworking, blue-collar, good people. And I think that's the one thing that we sell here. But it's authentic. It's not I say sell, but it's who we are. And I thought that was a great match. But that's how I recruited. And it was funny because I knew Jerry's girlfriend to his best friend wore my number, Chris Flynn, and I would talk to Flinny all the time, and I would recruit every different angle. And when my wife went in there and saw him get 40 points and being pregnant, I think that was when we closed the deal.
And what are you going to miss most about leaving the Big East?
Just the memories of the great coaches, the great players, the great competition, the great rivalries, the great arenas. Playing in Providence, I thought was just – it's an amazing place. Being in Eastern cities, I loved going. I loved going to play at Connecticut. The relationships, even, how Coach Thompson and Coach Boeheim and Coach Senior, John Thompson Senior, they were so competitive. But it was so cool for me to see It was kind of like Luke Skywalker versus Darth Vader, and then when John Thompson retired and they you saw him in different events, you saw the mutual respect. Even like Coach Calhoun and Coach Bam, they had so many just unbelievable battles. But there's so much respect, and that's what I thought the Big East was about. It was about respect of great programs, great coaches, great traditions. And it was something that, when it was built, it built the school, it built college basketball. You think about Syracuse. We've got, 10,000, 11,000 undergrads, 6,000 graduate students, whatever that may be. And we get 30,000 people or over for games. ESPN, the league, look at Providence College. Little colleges became names, brands. The coaching industry was born from making $35,000 a year wearing Procheds to getting million-dollar Nike deals. That was the explosion. That was the tipping point.
Is there something about the ACC that most appeals to you? Is there one thing you're looking forward to the most?
I think the greatest thing is the competition. It's the great. It could be the greatest league of all time. You've got Coach Williams, who's a Hall of Fame coach, Rick Pitino, Hall of Fame coach, Coach Boeheim, Hall of Fame coach, Mike Krzyzewski. You got two of the all-time winningest coaches in the history of college basketball. You've got amazing basketball traditions. The only difference is geographically, the playing goes a little bit different area, and you go end up playing in a college, more environment than, we played in these big NBA arenas and these big, East Coast cities. Now we're going to be going to college towns and college environments, but all it is a different navigational instrument used for a plane.
Does SU play the same game that's always played, or is it
no question? No question. Okay. And it's going to be interesting. A lot of the coaches we've played against. We've played against Coach Williams. We played him in when we won the national championship. We've played against Coach K three or four times. Coach Bam's has worked with Coach K for probably 15 to 20 years. I've had the opportunity for the last 8 with the World Championships and the Olympics. So we know them pretty good. You still have Pittsburgh. You still have Notre Dame. We played against Leonard Hamilton when he was the head coach at Miami. So there's a lot of familiarity. And we've competed against these guys, and they're amazing programs, amazing competitors, and that's what makes a great league.
Let me get to the 3 questions at the end. First, what's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
Patience.
Second, what's your worst trait?
I can't say no.
And finally, what professional or creative achievement in your life so far has surprised you the most?
Where I am today. I never thought that I would get into coaching. I was going to go work for my dad in business, but he couldn't hire me. And I ended up working with kids, and I loved it. I loved helping people get better. Loved it.
That was Mike Hopkins. Mike, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you very much.
I'm Grant Reher. Join me again next week on WRVO Public Media for more conversation in the public interest. You can also follow us on Twitter at Campbell Convos.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Research assistance was provided by Brooke Weinstein, Eric Lyons, and Alexandra Curtis. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. Visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations for more information.